Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Medieval Podcast with me. So today is a more, I guess, more relaxed episode and we are looking at how to survive the Middle Ages. So this kind of fun, relaxed episode, we're going to be basically looking at kind of medieval life and I guess the different pathways you could take, the different lives you could live, to kind of determine if you were to wake up in the medieval era, how could you survive it the best way possible? And it's going to be like a really interesting, I guess, insight into kind of the different levels of society, the different kind of types of pathways, and also, I guess, social mobility in the medieval era. We talk about kind of feudalism, this strict hierarchy that exists. You have your king, your church, your knights, your peasants. But actually what we see is kind of instances where this kind of hierarchy was far more flexible and fluid. People could traverse it up, equally they could traverse it down. And so let's kind of jump right into it. So we wake up and we are in the medieval era. Now the first kind of important, insight, the most important question really to determine is our sex. Are we male or are we female? Because this will kind of determine our path to begin with. Now, what it also determines really is also opportunities. Obviously, women in this period, compared to men, were greatly underappreciated. There was a grand disparity between men and women in this period. Now, there are examples, some beautiful examples, of kind of female empowerment when we look at, for instance, Adela of Blois or Eloise, the great writer and philosopher and churchwoman, who did exercise power and who were incredibly intelligent and valued and prominent in their lifetime, but these are few and far between. And so essentially, if we were to be born into the medieval era, let us say that it is in the 11th century, then there is, in a sense, little that we can do. We can become a nun, and many women did, and live at a nunnery or an abbey, and become an abbess potentially, or kind of just devote your life to kind of religion in that kind of sense. But that kind of, your path in a sense ends there. Aside from that, if you were born into nobility, you may have a chance, such as Adela, to be able to exercise power. But usually these women were exceptional at intrigue, family management, diplomacy, and were incredibly lucky in their kind of decisions. But of course, these were well thought out and incredibly intelligent women. And so you could, if you were a woman, exercise power, as we say. If you were a noble woman, then you could. But aside from that, if you were a noble woman, you would largely be at the whim of your husband. You would have to kind of deal with family management. So, for instance, have as many sons as you could, and help kind of manage court, manage kind of the home and the lifestyle of the noble house, and exercise kind of small degrees of management. Now, of course, we see plenty of female nobles in kind of their holdings setting up churches or abbeys or even towns, and you could do the same. If depending on how much kind of power you exercised, you may inherit certain lands from your father, depending on how your succession goes. We see that, of course, with Eleanor of Aquitaine, and of course from Adela of Blois as well, all of whom inherited lands and wealth from their parents through succession. And so then kind of holding on to their lands, then kind of reinvested and built them up, built abbesses, signed charters, exercised power. And so you could definitely do the same. But, like I say, this is if you were to be born in what is essentially the highest of the kind of social hierarchy. So you could be a woman who exercised grand power, you could be a mere nun. Not that there's a problem with that, because of course you could, in the case of Eloise, you could be such a grand part of, I guess, the kind of Latin theology, philosophy, and be an absolutely incredible, incredibly intelligent person. But if you were to be born on the kind of lower ends of, I guess, the social scale, i.e. a peasant, then there would not really be much for you in the way of opportunity. You would mostly be, at the whim of your husband. We do see instances of women being able to still travel around. You would still be able to go on pilgrimage. We see documents. Recently, I saw a document whereby a woman requests to go to St. James, so the Compostela in Spain or Iberia, to kind of go on pilgrimage with her son. And she was a peasant, so you would be able to do the same. And we see, for instance, at the shrine of at Oxford of Frideswide, that many women did visit the shrine and donate and place their vocation in that saint. So you can still partake in a lot of the kind of medieval aspects of life that we think of in terms of kind of visiting, traveling around. A lot of people think that peasants were stuck in one place, and at times they would be, especially if you maybe to do with agriculture, but nevertheless you could travel around and you could still do things. But when we go back to that original question, if you are born into the medieval era as a woman, unfortunately, because of the disparities and the kind of gender differences, your opportunities are limited. And so let us now cut to the male sex then. So we are born as a male. Now, the next question, if we imagine it almost as a flowchart, are, what gender are you going to go across? You know, now we're on to the next tier. The next tier is, which son are you? Now, this is incredibly important because this can determine your life from the get-go. If you are a first son, so you're the eldest son, then essentially you are to inherit the primary titles of kind of your family. You are to be the next duke, the next king, the next whatever it may be. And so you have an incredible role from the beginning of your life, because a lot depends on you. And as soon as a family secures their first son, a great amount of relief is taken off of them. So, of course, you might not be. What happens if you're a second son, or dare we say even a third son? It's a little bit more difficult. If you're a second son, there is still a chance that you could inherit the primary titles if the first son died. You may also inherit other titles, the kind of the secondary titles, which is still kind of prominent in a sense. And you may still have claims on certain things. But as a third son, it's very unlikely that you may have certain titles or succession rights. Now, of course, when we look at Charlemagne, his kingdom was divided up later equally amongst, it was Western Francia, Eastern Francia, Lotharingia. The kind of three kind of kingdoms that was divided amongst the sons equally. So it depends also on the succession rights of your kingdom. But later down the line, when we see things like high partition come into play with succession laws, the third son, you're getting little to nothing. Now you may devote your life as what's called an oblate. Your parents may see that you will inherit nothing, so, and they may see that you will have a better life within the church. Because as kind of a nobleman, a noble son, you can actually kind of gain a lot of prominence in the church. You may become a bishop, maybe even an archbishop, maybe even the Pope himself. So, which is very good, and that's something that you could otherwise, without being part of the church, you wouldn't be able to obtain much else. So if you became an oblate, you get gifted to the church at a very young age, you study, you learn Latin, you learn theology, philosophy, all these different types of aspects, you may then be granted by election your own church, you may become a bishop, you may then rise up to have your own abbey. And when we look at, for instance, Suger of Saint-Denis, the abbey becomes incredibly important, and you're mixing with high-born people, you're mixing with kings and emperors and dukes, you know, all these different aspects, and you become an incredibly important power player that you otherwise wouldn't have been. Returning back to the second son, now this is particularly interesting when we consider the Crusades. Now, many historians have regarded the Crusades as kind of the war for second sons, kind of somewhere along that line. The reason being is because if you were to go on Crusade, you renounced your titles. Some people fought firstborns, did, some didn't, because to kind of give up all your titles to go to war, it can cause issues. Nevertheless, as a second son, there was almost nothing to lose. So you renounce your titles, you come in as a nobleman, perhaps a commander of sorts, you have your own army of men. Perhaps when we look at kind of when Eleanor of Aquitaine visits the Holy Lands, she does so to alongside the Aquitaine kind of garrison, the army. So you may, if you were a count, for instance, may have a small army within your kind of barony or whatever it may be, that that you take to crusade. Now, when we look at the most prolific, one of the most prolific people, Bohemund of Antioch, he was the son of Robert Guiscard. And basically, when Robert was taken seriously ill, the eldest son, the 13-year-old Roger Borsa, became kind of the heir. And essentially, Bohemund, being kind of the second son, then fought in his army's war and became a commander, became a prominent knight, and was able to build himself up through a series of victories to be quite a prominent person. The Crusades happen, and there we go. He suddenly becomes the Prince of Antioch. What an extremely prominent position. And we see this time and time again. If you look at the Le Puisé family, they become the counts of Jaffar, the kind of palatines of different regions, the archbishops of in the Holy Land. You know, you can really kind of strike your own pathway because of the Crusades. And as such, being a second son during this period, there is a lot of kind of room for social mobility. Even so much so that we see lower nobles become kind of emerge into like the top positions of power. We see, we should remember that Bohemund Robert Guiscard was the Count of Apulia and Calabria. He's only a count by those accords. But nevertheless, Bohemund becomes the Prince of Antioch, one of the most prolific and powerful regions in the Crusades. And so, if you are a second son, there is a good amount of space for you to be able to flex your kind of muscles, whether it be through becoming a churchman and working your way up towards, I guess, archbishophood, potentially even becoming a saint if you are holy enough. Or you become a knight, you train from a very young age, become a squire or a steward to a higher born person, kind of picking up the ropes. Then you become kind of a commanding authority, perhaps even a commander in your father's army or your liege's army, whatever it may be, and then you work your way up through that, especially if you are victorious. We see plenty of instances, for example, in the Byzantine Empire, where commanding officers become emperors, which is pretty prolific when we think about it. And so, you know, not all hope is lost if you are a second son. Now, it should also be known that we've gone from kind of, I guess, two different ends of the spectrum. We've gone from kind of looking at the peasants to looking at the highborns. But there is somewhere in the middle, kind of what's known as, well, I guess we can say the gentry, merchants, artisans, etc. Now, if you were born as a male in the Middle Ages, in kind of, I guess, what you could argue is kind of not so much the working class, maybe like upper working class, but more so middle class of society, if we talk about that in kind of modern terms, then you could undertake some sort of apprenticeship. Perhaps you become a blacksmith, perhaps you go into tanning or textiles, whatever it may be, depending on which country you're in. You could quite prominently strike your own kind of enterprise through that. And many people did. Many people got rich from kind of textile industry, whatever it may be, depending on which country they were in. And you could make quite a good living for yourself. It's not a bad practice, you know, if you went into whatever it may be. But if you were a merchant, this is where I guess you can really kind of make yourself known. Marco Polo, for instance, was a merchant, and he is one of the most prolific and important people of the medieval era through his travels. And so if you were a Venetian or Genoese merchant, you were making bank. You would be able to carve out power and wealth for yourself and for your family quite easily. And this is really kind of important when we talk about kind of, I guess, not only social mobility, but also physical mobility. Because if you owned maybe not a fleet of ships, but some ships that you could trade with, then kind of the world definitely is your oyster. And you could really harness the different industries and carve out kind of your path, which is why Genoa and Venice became so prolific and rich. And this is where also, when we look at some of the city-states, where we look at, for instance, I guess, the Medici family, when it comes to wealth, people who were, I guess, let's say lower nobles or kind of that kind of gentry, could kind of increase their social mobility over generations because of wealth. And we see that with, for instance, the Medici family or even the Borgias, you know. And so that's a really important thing. But it's important to state, really, that when it comes to wealth, I guess your kind of social mobility is perhaps a bit slower than it may be. And by slower, I mean it might be over a few generations, because you have to kind of establish yourself, maintain your prominence, and kind of expand your prominence, which is perhaps potentially difficult to do within one generation. And the same could be said for, you know, for other aspects. But I guess when we look at kind of military prowess, you know, the Crusades, we see Bohemond within a lifetime becoming a prominent figure. Nevertheless, though, you know, these are all really important factors of society. And, you know, when we think about, I guess, surviving the Middle Ages, it seems like your best bet, quite clearly, is to kind of be a high-born male, or female, to be fair. But if you really want to be able to exercise power, freedoms, and liberties, then of course it would have to be male. But nevertheless, there we have it. Kind of a really big overview, of course. You can really go into depth on certain case studies, you know, especially when we look at kind of the city-states that didn't rule through a monarchy, but rather through families, you know. And then, of course, when we take into consideration the Black Death, you see notaries in Italy who were doing the administration of just kind of warehouse itineraries, suddenly being able to kind of, through the lack of jobs because of the Black Death, being able to kind of scale up all the way up to like the most prominent courts, you know, the high courts of these city states. And so, you know, when we talk about, I guess, the whole era, we should specify certain periods. But nevertheless, that is a really nice overview, I think. And quite an interesting one, nevertheless. I think it's really interesting to dive into kind of the different pathways that one could take, because sometimes it's the simplest of questions that can actually tell us quite a lot, really. To ask yourself, okay, if I was born as a second son in the Middle Ages, what were my prospects? You know, where would that lead me? Which is really interesting to look at. And so there we go. So thank you very much for listening. And whether it be that you're a knight carving out your Arthurian tale, if you're a nun learning the liturgical canons or whatever it may be, or a king, or even a peasant, I hope you enjoyed, and I hope that you enjoy my other videos as well. So thank you very much.